Inclusion at this point does not, however, include open access to this exhilarating world of flight by all of the citizens of our great nation. I see, as I look back, many highly qualified African Americans just itching for an opportunity to learn to fly military aircraft so that they could fly in defense of, and if necessary, give their all for their nation, our nation, America. But they could not just sit and wait. They had to do something to hasten the day. And so then, I see two pioneering black aviators, Dale White and Chauncey Spencer. I see these two aviators saying to one another, "We must at all cost demonstrate that we can fly and we deserve an opportunity to participate as combat aviators." I see these pioneering aviators scrounging funds from any source that they could, combining that with their own meager resources, renting an ancient Lincoln Page biplane and flying it from Chicago to Washington to draw attention to the lack of opportunity for African Americans to learn to fly, particularly to fly combat military aircraft in defense of our nation. And if you listen carefully, you will also hear then Harry Truman saying to these young men, "If you guys had guts enough to fly that thing all the way from Chicago to Washington, then I have guts enough to see that you get what you're asking for." And then visualize with me, if you will, the wife of the then President of the United States of America, against the strong advice and almost physical restraint of her, insisted that she be able to fly with a black man to see whether they could fly. Picture, if you will, Mrs. Roosevelt climbing into the back seat of this aircraft with a person that we revere, Chief Anderson, a black man. He took her up, flew her around Tuskegee, Alabama, landed the aircraft, and when she got out, her only words were, "They seem to fly all right to me." Well, with that kind of endorsement, and that of the historically black college Tuskegee, the press, and the courts, the naysayers now concluded that it was time for this noble experiment. So the civilian pilot training program to teach young people to fly started to accept more and more black people. Colonel Elmer Jones took advantage of that one very well. And then came the program conducted here at Chanute, the program to train African Americans to be the core of the maintenance of the ground crews in all of the fields of electronics, engineering, flight, repair, mechanics, and all of this in those particular skills that were needed. Again, Colonel Jones, Colonel Thompson, four others entered this program, this aviation cadet program, non-flying. So, and again, on orders of the War Department, an airbase began to rise from the red clay farmland near Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University in Alabama. You see, I was also caught up in this hysteria of flight. And like a number of others, I applied for aviation cadet flight training, passed all of the tests with very high scores, was told to go home then and wait. Subsequently, my papers were, quote, lost, unquote. So as a result, with the urging of my draft board, I entered the Army Air Corps at the lowest enlisted rank, private, but rose rapidly through the ranks to the top enlisted grade of first sergeant. And to this newly established flying program came these patriotic African-American men that I mentioned earlier, later called Tuskegee Airmen, highly qualified and eager They came from all over the United States. So many of them came that some came to this base in Mississippi, Biloxi, Mississippi, where I gave them basic military training, some psychological, some psychomotive tests. And then even though they were found fully qualified, many of these embryo pilots had to be held back in a pool until this rigid quota system would permit them to be shipped on to Tuskegee for flight training. Yet they continued to come from the south, from the east, from the west, the north, with only one objective in mind, to be the very best combat pilots that the world had ever known, or, and some say of even greater importance, to be the very best support personnel. Because all of them knew from experience that in order to succeed, that they had to be the very best, the 10 to 1 or more support men and women, many of them trained here, worked so hard, they knew that they had to support these embryo flyers the best way that they knew how. All of them knew that this noble experiment, as this project was called, was expected to fail and to prove once and for all the, quote, wisdom, if you will, unquote, of keeping blacks out of the cockpits of military aircraft. However, when these Tuskegee Airmen sought the opportunity to fly or to provide essential ground support, they were fully qualified. They were ready. Working alongside these embryo pilots, making sure that their ground support needs, including mechanics, medicines, cooks, transportation, and so forth, were satisfied. Yes, it took all of this and more for these pioneers to become an effective fighting unit. It took leadership, and many of the leaders emerged during that training. Too many to name, but some of them are here with you this evening. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. Right in the middle of all of this beehive of activity, I can see a then colonel, later general, dedicated person, white man, Noel F. Parrish, working hard to provide the very best training possible while walking a tight rope between the demands of fairness and the demands of doing his best and those of the bigots who surrounded him. Then picture, if you will, this ramrod straight, recent graduate of West Point, first to graduate from West Point in our past century, Benjamin O. Davis, who had been silenced, if you will, never spoken to except in the line of duty while he was at our military academy, West Point. But he overcame that, graduated in the top 10% of his class. But then he took over, first with the 99th Pursuit Squadron, and honed these already well-trained, dedicated young men into a razor-sharp fighting unit that would deploy with its essential support elements, including those who had been trained to do second echelon maintenance, to the North Africa theater of operation, the 99th Pursuit Squadron, the 99th that was activated here at Chanute. So you see, it all began here, if you will. The 99th Squadron operating from that area on into Sicily and other areas contingent to North Africa, doing strafing, support work, escort work, and all of that. Later joining the 332nd fighter group that had deployed to Europe, to Italy. But you see, the 99th was the first to engage the enemy in combat. But together, initially the 99th acting alone, and then the rest of the 332nd, all together, proceeding to write page after page of glorious history in combat against the best that the Luftwaffe, or German Air Force, as you will, could throw at them. Their ground support personnel, understandably, had to perform at peak efficiency. And so well did they perform that they not only supported the 99th, and of course the rest of the 332nd fighter group, but they were called on to support other allied operational units in the area. The latter also earned these supporters a well-deserved Bronze Star, Distinguished Unit Citation, and other important official recognition. In these historical pages are recorded deeds which were considered improbable, if not impossible. A painting in the Pentagon entitled Drop Tanks and Follow Me tells a story of the extraordinary courage of these Tuskegee Airmen, who were first Italy-based group to fly all the way to Berlin and return some 800 miles one way. The first Americans to score victories over the hottest fighter in the German inventory, or in the world, if you will, the Messerschmitt 262 jet fighter. This particular mission was made necessary because the American fighter group that was to relieve the 332nd on this escort mission, for some reason, didn't show on time. No criticism there, but just circumstances as to what happened. The Tuskegee Airmen, even though low on fuel, remained in the area to bring the bombers home. Over Berlin, I understand that they spotted a swarm of German aircraft, including this ME-262 jet aircraft, climbing to challenge them, undeterred by the fact that they were flying P-51 propeller-driven aircraft. Roscoe Brown, now a retired college president, and his wingman eagerly engaged these enemy jet aircraft and shot down three of them, and prior to that, only two German jets had been shot down by Americans. Another flight of these intrepid warriors, led by Wendell Pruitt, returning to base over the Mediterranean Sea, spotted a German destroyer, engaged it with machine gun fire only, and sank that destroyer. Again, most improbable, perhaps even impossible, in the thoughts of those who would think of such deeds. And then we think of people like Detroiters who come to mind, Carl Carey, Washington Ross, Harry Stewart, who I happen to know personally, had varying numbers of confirmed victories over German fighters to their credit. Lee Archer, retired Fortune 500 vice president, very successful entrepreneur in New York, recently had the number of aircraft destroyed from him increased from 4.5 to 5, thus making him an ace. Also among the seemingly impossible deeds performed by these gallant warriors is that during the over 200 bomber escort missions over enemy-infested, war-torn territory, they never lost an American bomber that they were escorting to German fighter aircraft. Not one. They never forgot their mission: defend the bombers, bring home the bombers. It is my understanding that these Red Tails, as they were called because the tails on the aircraft were symbolically painted red, were frequently requested to escort. I don't know whether that worked or not, but in any case, I know that there are a number of bomber crew members who still come to our conventions, and they come stating that their only reason for being there is to express their appreciation for the fine job of escort that our Tuskegee Airmen did. And they tell tales of when they felt that they were certainly doomed, and our guys showed and saved them and got them back to Allied lines. So the last four enemy aircraft shot down in the Mediterranean Theater of Operations during World War II on April 25th, 1945, were shot down by the Tuskegee Airmen. 11 days later, the war in Europe ended. Such achievements, though, were not without the payment of a high price by these gallant Tuskegee Airmen, not only the pilots, but their air crew members, the ground crew members, I should say, were also subjected to the dangers of operating in enemy territory and clear next close to that. So out of all of them, some were wounded, others were such as Detroiter that happened to know personally, Alex Jefferson, Richard Macon was shot down, taken prisoner, because some did not come home at all. Their names are inscribed on a marble plaque for our fallen warriors in the museum there at historic Fort Wayne in Detroit, because they gave their last true measure of strength and life defending those bombers and defending our freedoms as well. With the total of some over 900 pilots graduating from Tuskegee Army Airfield, 450 of them, and their approximately 10-to-1 dedicated support personnel saw overseas duty, flew over 15,500 combat sorties in which they destroyed or damaged over 500 enemy aircraft and untold quantities of enemy war materials. For their prowess, for their dedication, for their excellence, they were awarded the Presidential Distinguished Unit Citation, some 744 air medals, 94 Distinguished Flying Crosses, the Legion of Merit, Silver Star. Even so, throughout this whole experience, these intrepid warriors were dedicated, patriotic, loyal American citizens who did what they did because they saw this as being necessary to defend our nation. These African American citizens overcame the crippling effects of segregation and discrimination, and they proved to the world that in defense of their nation, our nation, that they could and they would fly and fight along with the very best. But now the end of the war is coming into view. First, the victory in Europe, which was hastened by these gallant and intrepid warriors. Shortly thereafter, before the 477th Medium Bomb Group, which had also trained at Tuskegee and many of those ground support people trained here and in other bases throughout the country, was combat ready, but it could not be deployed to combat. The atomic bomb put an end to the hostilities in the Pacific before this could occur. The Tuskegee Airmen, having contributed greatly to the victory over the would-be dictators of the world, continued their fight. Some left the service and became successful business, government, or professional persons, such as the former mayor of Detroit, former lieutenant governor of Colorado, borough president of Manhattan, school teachers, principals, vice presidents, college presidents, top-level government servants, such as my friend Elmer Jones, very top. Others remained in the service, became staff sergeants, technical sergeants, master sergeants, seniors, chiefs, captains, majors, lieutenant colonels, colonels, and three of us became general officers. The Tuskegee Airmen 332nd Fighter Group, which included, of course, the great 99th Pursuit Squadron, which you honor here by your exhibit, was then inactivated after World War II and the armed forces integrated. It has been reactivated as the 332nd Air Expeditionary Group. And when I had the privilege of visiting that group in Kuwait a couple of years ago, I found this group to be fully integrated, proudly and gallantly, keeping the legend of the Tuskegee Airmen alive and well. It is now continuing its indispensable contributions to our war effort at a base in Iraq. The Tuskegee Airmen's exemplary performance, without a doubt, led to revolutionary changes in the armed forces of the United States of America, helped to open the way to progress for such individuals as General Benjamin O. Davis Jr. himself, General Daniel Chaffee James, Bernard Randolph, Lloyd Fig Newton, past Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force, or Assistant Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Commander of the Air Force Materiel Command, General Lester Lyles, retired, former Chiefs, the National Guard Bureau, Lieutenant General Russell Davis, Lieutenant Chaffee Daniel James III, I should say, who has now announced his retirement, former Vice Commander, the Air Education and Training Command, Lieutenant General John Hopper, who didn't serve as a Tuskegee Airman, but benefited from the trail being broken open for him. Astronaut Guyon Bluford. And so the list goes on and on. The performance of those Tuskegee Airmen, those young, brave, patriotic men, many of them who benefited from the training that was conducted here at Chanute, contributed much to further integration of our total society by their examples. This again clearly demonstrated that with preparation, dedication, hard work, and a constant pursuit of excellence and teamwork, one can achieve practically anything that he or she wishes in America today. I say, where else, but in America? Where else? Do you agree? And if not, why is it that so many people are fighting to get into America any way that they can? Also, ladies and gentlemen, the contributions of our Tuskegee Airmen were recognized by the Congress of the United States of America because on April the 11th, President signed a public law, 109-213, awarding collectively to the Tuskegee Airmen the nation's highest honor, the Congressional Gold Medal. This has been signed and sealed by our president. Don't you agree that this is great recognition, well earned by the support personnel and the pilots, air crew members of the Tuskegee Airmen? Do you agree, ladies and gentlemen? And so then, ladies and gentlemen, it's really been a real honor and a pleasure being with you this evening. And I close by wishing each and every one of you that as you continue your laudable efforts to preserve and display the history of the past contributions of our citizens, of our great nation, as a guide for our youth and our adults, I say to you in closing, good luck, Godspeed. God bless all of you, and God bless America. Thank you.
You've been listening to an address from Major General Lucius Thais, who chaired a task force that established the military's Race Relations Board. He addressed a crowd at the Chanute Air Museum on June 3rd. General Thais was among the dignitaries present as an exhibit was unveiled honoring the Tuskegee Airmen's 99th Pursuit Squadron. For more information on the exhibit, visit the museum's website at aeromuseum.org.
Emergency alert system. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Academy for Entrepreneurial Leadership at the University of Illinois, a resource for UIUC faculty and students with entrepreneurial ideas and aspirations. More information on the Academy can be found at www.ael.uiuc.edu.
Text of a speech given by the King of England spread through this town, spread through Boston like wildfire, and out into the countryside. Because the king had said that the Americans are in rebellion and that their leaders are traitors and that we are going to crush that rebellion.
Welcome to the Cambridge Forum with David McCullough discussing 1776. I'm Bill Fowler, the director of the Massachusetts Historical Society. Is there a literate citizen in our republic who does not know David McCullough? He's been into your living room via the American Experience and the Civil War. He has received two Pulitzer Prizes for Truman and John Adams, and has twice received the National Book Award for Path Between the Seas and Mornings on Horseback. He has received 31 honorary degrees, addressed a joint session of the United States Congress, and spoken at the White House. His newest book, 1776, tells the story of the American Revolution as experienced by George Washington and the men who marched with him, as well as loyalists and Hessian mercenaries, politicians, preachers, traitors, and spies, men and women of all kinds caught in the path of war. And here this evening to bring that year alive for all of us, David McCullough.
Thank you.
One of the hardest things, it seems to me, to convey in teaching history or writing history, and one of the most important to convey, is that nothing ever had to happen the way it happened. We're so often presented history as this, following that, and we're meant to get that straight because it will be on the test on Wednesday. And we begin to think, after a good many years of that process, that that had to be that way. And it never did. Events of all kinds could have gone off in any number of different directions anywhere along the line, just as in our own lives. 1776 was the most important year of the most important conflict in our history, the Revolutionary War. Without the Revolutionary War, there would be no United States of America. The Revolutionary War, furthermore, was the longest war in our history, except for Vietnam, 8.5 years. And it was the bloodiest war in our history, except for the Civil War. 25,000 Americans lost their lives. Now, that doesn't seem like very much by our terms, but by their terms, it was catastrophic. 1% of the population, 2,500,000 people in all of the 13 colonies. Were we fighting such a war today, we would lose over 3 million people, to give you some idea of what they sacrificed. And of course, the dead are not the only sacrifice, nor were the soldiers who marched with Washington the only people who suffered. But suffer they did, nor did it look very encouraging, ever. There was a night in the winter of 1776, early in 1776, just up the way here on Brattle Street at what we call the Longfellow House, which was Washington's headquarters, and ought to be so understood as to be that, as well as the Longfellow House, when Washington was tossing and turning at night, unable to sleep, as he recorded in a letter, "The reflection upon my situation and that of this army produces many an uneasy hour, when all around me are wrapped in sleep. Few people know the predicament we are in." So it isn't just that we don't know today what they suffered then, what they went through then, how bleak, how dark, how in many ways hopeless it appeared, but he's saying that few people then knew. Now, who were they? Well, we have a pretty good idea who George Washington was, but in my view, we need to know more. He's not the marble man. He's not unapproachable. He's a leader. He isn't an intellectual like John Adams or Jefferson. He isn't a great strategist or tactician like Napoleon. He isn't a passionate, persuasive speaker like Patrick Henry. He's a leader. He has absolute integrity. He has phenomenal courage, which is the first thing required in a leader because everything else depends on that. And it's both physical and moral courage. He is steadfast. He will not quit. And he never loses sight of what the war is about. And he conveys this courage and dedication to the glorious cause of America, as they called it, in such a way that others feel deeply his feelings and will follow him through hell. Now, not all of them did, by any means. Not all of them were heroes. They deserted in droves by the hundreds. Many, when their enlistments were up, marched right off to home as fast as they could go, by the thousands, both from here and later on in December, when Washington was retreating across New Jersey and couldn't spare a man, let alone 2,000 of his men, who just walked away with no shame whatsoever when they were most desperately needed. And many went over to the enemy. We mustn't forget that. Hundreds of them went over to the enemy, right here, just as many of the enemy came over to our side. There was a lot of back and forthing, often depending whether there was food enough to keep them going or clothes enough to keep them warm. British sentries froze to death here around Boston in that winter. The only losses, the only American fatalities during the attack at Trenton were two men on the 9-mile march after they had crossed the Delaware, on the 9-mile march down to Trenton to hit Trenton the next morning, who died on the march because they froze to death. And yes, they did, many of them have no shoes, and yes, they did leave bloody footprints in the snow. All true. But George Washington was also a man. He bore a burden of gloom and doom such as I don't know of any man carrying in such a position of tremendous responsibility. This is also true of Henry Knox. Henry Knox was a Boston bookseller, a great, big, fat, gregarious young man that everybody liked and who was impossible to ignore. He had the idea to go to Ticonderoga and bring back the guns left there after Ethan Allen and his Green Mountain Boys had captured the fort in May of the early of 1775. The guns were still there, but Fort Ticonderoga was over 300 miles away in upstate New York, and he proposed to do this in the midst of winter, and he did it. Now, what's so interesting is that Henry Knox was 25 years old. Henry Knox knew no more about the military or artillery than what he'd read in books. Nor did Nathaniel Greene from Rhode Island, who was all of 33 when they made him a general, knew no more about the military or being in the army or fighting a war than what he'd read in books. But you see, that was an age when people believed that reading books wasn't a bad way to learn things. That's the spirit of the Enlightenment, the faith of the Enlightenment, vividly personified by these two men who, like Washington, had no formal schooling beyond about fifth grade, but who never stopped reading. And of course, it was a young man's war, a young woman's war, a young cause. Washington was 43 when he took command here in Cambridge. We see the old fellow in his white powdered hair and the awkward teeth, the founding father, the elder statesman. He wasn't that yet, not for a very long time to come. And he was the oldest of them. Jefferson was 33 when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, 33 years old. Benjamin Rush, who in many ways is one of the most interesting of them all, the famous physician of that time who was the first to urge that people with mental illness be treated humanely. Benjamin Rush was all of 30 years old when he signed the Declaration of Independence. They're young, they're inexperienced. They've never fought a revolution. No people had ever successfully revolted against the mother country. This country had no army, it had no navy, it had no money, and it had no prior experience. There was no Che Guevara who'd done it before somewhere else. And they'd never founded a country. And they're all coming out of this tiny population of 2,500,000 people, 500,000 of whom, as you might recall, were held in bondage as slaves black men, women, and children. And of course, there is the glaring incongruity that many of them were themselves slave masters, including George Washington. They postponed that issue, as they would postpone that issue again with the Constitution. All men are created equal. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To what extent did the Declaration of Independence inspire these soldiers? Very hard to know for certain. It certainly was a powerful morale moment when Washington ordered that the Declaration of Independence be read aloud to everybody, all of the army in New York, when the document itself reached New York in its full text. And when that happened, I just tell you that what happened was that Knox said, "Now, how we play our parts will affect generations and generations to come." That's an extremely important observation, because Knox is saying how we play our parts, and this idea that they are cast in roles unlike anybody has ever been cast before. In one of the great dramatic turning points in history, permeates all that they say. Washington, Adams, Knox, Green, all of them. Except when you get down in the ranks, you don't read that much. There is no mention that I know of in the memoir of Joseph Plum Martin, a 16-year-old army volunteer, soldier, foot soldier, who wrote a wonderful memoir later. There's no mention of it in the diaries of Jabez Fitch, another Connecticut farmer with 8 children. No mention of the Declaration of Independence that I know of in the papers of my favorite Joseph Hodgkins, who was a cobbler from Ipswich. They may have indeed been fighting for the Declaration of Independence and its noble ideals, but they don't talk about it much. They talk about winning. They talk about surviving till the next day. They talk about doing their part, and they talk again and again about the glorious cause of America. Now, keep in mind that when the soldiers who went out to face the British redcoats at Lexington and Concord leveled their muskets on the enemy, they were not fighting for independence, nor were they doing so at Bunker Hill. They were fighting, in their view, in their hearts and minds, for their rights as freeborn Englishmen. It is only in 1776 when this idea of independence takes hold, and it's only after a text of a speech given by the King of England before Parliament in October arrives here in Boston, in Cambridge, on the very first day of the new year, January 1, 1776. And word of that text, of that speech, spread through this town, spread through Boston like wildfire, and out into the countryside. Because the king had said that the Americans are in rebellion, and that their leaders are traitors, and that we are going to crush that rebellion. In other words, it wasn't just going to be a brief family squabble. Washington wrote his wife, Martha, that he would be home by Christmas. That thought all passed, by the way, on the first day of January 1776. When one finishes reading about this year, when you live inside the diaries and letters of the people who were there, who saw it, who fought it, who survived it, you come away with several very powerful feelings that I think, for me at least, will stay with me for the rest of my life. One is that they did everything for us, because the words of the Declaration of Independence would have been just that, words on paper, had it not been for them. That when we celebrate the 4th of July, we shouldn't just be celebrating those noble ideals. That's important for sure. We shouldn't just be imagining the 1776 of the Broadway show. All those eminent leaders in their magnificent 18th century attire parading around on stage like somebody in a costume pageant. That was part of it, and a very important part. But there are these other people, mostly long forgotten, but by no means have their traces been eliminated. They are there. We can read what happened. We can hear their voices in their own words. If our satisfaction with ourselves, if our abundance and our amplitude of opportunities are so hypnotizing to us that we forget about those people and we take what we have for granted, what kind of a country are we? We profess we love our country. What would somebody who professes to love another man or another woman or your father or your mother, but knows nothing about them, what kind of love would that be? We are a very interesting country. And the shame of it is that so few people know much about it. Now, I don't think we ought to read history and read about the Revolutionary War because it's necessarily going to make us more grateful for what we have. It will. Or that it'll make us a better citizen. It will. Or that it will help us to understand human nature far better than almost anything else one could study. And it will. But also as a source of pleasure. You couldn't invent a novel that would have such incredible events that take place as in this year, 1776. You read what happened and you say, that just doesn't happen in real life. But it did. When time and again, the weather, literally which way the wind was blowing, would determine the outcome, not just of one battle or one engagement, but of the war. If the wind had been in a different direction the night of August 29th, 1776, on the East River in New York, I think it would have been all over, because it would have taken only the British fleet to come up into the East River and seal off any possible escape by Washington and the Army from Brooklyn Heights. They would have had them right in the bag, exactly the same way we had the British in the bag at Yorktown when the French fleet arrived at exactly the right time to seal off any retreat there, one of the great ironies of the war. There's one point when the Continental Army is retreating across New Jersey, when all they have left are 3,000 men. Probably a fourth of whom are sick. Most of them have no winter clothing. They've done nothing but lose and lose and lose again for months. 3,000 men and the whole future of the country and all that the Declaration embodied was riding on those people. So what Washington did when all hope was lost is what we often have to do when all hope is lost. He attacked. He came across the Delaware, struck at Trenton, and history changed because we had beaten them. It wasn't a big battle. It wasn't a grand European-style conflict. But it changed history because it changed what was in people's hearts, their morale, their attitude. And then he struck a few days later in the first week of 1777 at Princeton and won again. I've been at this now for 40 years, and I've loved the work I've done on every book I've written. But I have never enjoyed so much what I've been doing as working in the 18th century. There's something about those people from whom we can learn more than we have any idea, and how fortunate we are that they did what they did. That's my talk.
This is the Cambridge Forum with David McCullough, speaking about his book, 1776. Now the floor is yours, and Mr. McCullough is willing to take some questions.
In your remarks, you've stressed integrity of the leadership as one of the prime requisites. I'm sure as you write and delve into the history that you make comparisons between yesterday and today. I wonder if you'd share them with us.
I think that George Washington was the greatest president in our history because he was a unifying figure both through the war and as president. He was exactly the right man for his times. And I think that we, among the miracles of 1776, among the miracles that made possible our whole way of life, is the fact that there, at the very beginning, we had a man of that kind. Now, exceptional presidents are the exception. And we shouldn't expect, nor has history illustrated, that great presidents come along all the time. They don't. Sometimes the times create them, sometimes it's otherwise. I think what comes through more from the period of the Revolution and the creation of the country is not that they were ideal, not that they were superhuman or gods. They weren't. They were human beings. And they each had flaws, weaknesses, failings. They all made mistakes. Washington in 1776 made some horrendous mistakes, almost finished us off. But that they never quit. They never quit trying to do their best. And their willingness to serve the country is the real example they set. That's what we have to get back into American life. I think our advantage is not only that they weren't perfect, but what they did wasn't perfect. We are work in progress. The United States of America is work in progress. It's the continuing experiment. We are left with the responsibility to try and make it work even better, more justice, more equality, more fairness, and so forth. And that's our advantage. If it were all handed to us on the platter, that wouldn't be very good for anybody. Yes, ma'am.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts on who are some famous female figures from history who haven't been written about much, and do you have any plans to write about them? Thank you.
There are at least 12 women in the book I have written who figure very importantly. Now, that doesn't mean that they occupy many pages, though some do. Catherine Greene, Nathaniel Greene's wife, extremely interesting. Martha Washington, who came here to Cambridge and stayed in the Longfellow House. That's another ghost you might find at the Longfellow House. Abigail Adams. I think Abigail Adams is one of the greatest Americans who ever lived, and certainly one of the greatest writers who ever lived. Mercy Warren, one of the first historians we ever produced, and who wrote one of the first histories of the Revolutionary War. There was Dorcas Griffith, who ran a low grog shop in Boston, who was known as John Hancock's discarded mistress. Mary Lindley Murray, supposedly, it's a lovely story, she supposedly offered tea to the British generals when they were chasing Washington and stalled them long enough for Washington to get away. She probably did offer them tea, but it wasn't her feminine wiles which slowed them down. They didn't have any intention to hurrying anyway. Molly Corbin. Molly Corbin was from Pennsylvania, and she went to war with her husband, as some women did, and she was beside him when he was firing a cannon at Fort Washington during the siege of Fort Washington in New York, and when he was hit and killed, she took over and manned the cannon until she was hit, nearly lost her arm, but survived. So, yes, there are many women who were involved, and there are many of them that I admire and enormously, and I wish we knew more about them. The problem is that very few, comparatively few women, in comparison to the men, wrote the letters and diaries that we're dependent on. And that's what makes Abigail Adams such a remarkable figure, because if she'd done nothing else but write the letters she wrote, she served her country in a grand fashion. Yes, sir.
What if the winds had been in the British favor on August 29th and George Washington had been captured? What would have happened?
Well, if George Washington had been captured, and he was nearly captured several times, he lost his self-control at Kips Bay. He had saw hundreds of his men running like rabbits, cowards in his view, and he just lost it. He started using his whip on people. He pulled his pistol on some of the officers. He rode very close up to the enemy lines. He could have been shot. He could have been captured. It was only when two of his aides were able to grab a hold of the bridle of the horse and pull him off the battlefield. If he had been captured then, if he had been captured at Brooklyn, I think the war would have been over. I think he would have been taken to London and put on trial. and that would have been something. Whether he would have been hanged is a very debatable question, because if they wanted truly to have us re-enter into the family, so to speak, and return as part of the British Empire, I don't think they could ever have hanged him. And incidentally, he was picked as the general not because he was a great military man. He was picked as a general by his fellow members of the Continental Congress because they knew him as a man. They knew him as a fellow politician. And as a politician, he never, ever forgot who was boss. Congress was boss. We've been blessed with our political generals, our George Marshalls and our Dwight Eisenhowers, Colin Powells. That's the kind of general a democracy should produce. Anyway, when the war was over, he relinquished his power, gave it back to Congress. And there's a marvelous painting by Trumbull of that scene hanging in the rotunda in Washington at the Capitol. Maybe many of you have seen it. Well, when Benjamin West, who was an American painter who had become the court painter in London, told George III after the war was over that Washington might do this, George III said, if he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world. So there was an underlying respect for Washington that makes me believe they never would have hanged him. They would have tried him, and they might have hanged a couple of others. They might have hanged Adams, for example. And there was a list. It wasn't very long, and Adams was one of them. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Melissa. I'm a textbook editor at a publishing company, and it's really an honor to be here today and meet you. I'm working on a series of biographies and of people in America's past right now, and just wondering what the biggest challenge you've come across in your career as a writer and how you've gone through it.
Well, I'm very glad you're working on a series of biographies. There's a great need for biographies for young people. I think the greatest challenge is to make it as interesting as it really was. You don't have to trick it up. You don't have to use little ways of making it interesting. Just say what happened accurately and with a feeling for the humanity involved. C.S. Forster, in his book on the art of fiction, gave an example of the difference between a sequence of events and a story. In a sequence of events, if I say to you the king